Six Music.
BBC Radio. Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to the first time here on Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest may have made his name as one half of the guitar and drum band The Black Keys, but his impact and influence goes far beyond that. As a producer and working musician, he's collaborated with, played for or produced The Pretenders, Danger Mouse, A$AP Rocky, Lana Del Rey, Ray LaMontagna and Dr. John. My guest on the first time this week is Dan Auerbach. Here we look at Dan's earliest musical influences growing up in Ohio, bluegrass and country, the impact of his dad's staggering vinyl collection and his formative gigging experiences, seeing the Grateful Dead and Whitney Houston. Not together, sadly. He discusses the formation and the huge success of the Black Keys, working with Danger Mouse and Dr. John, and his passions for J.J. Cale, T-Rex, The Sonics and Link Wray. But I started by asking Dan, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, my mom played piano. She was a piano teacher, so she used to play all the time. So I heard that. And my mom's family played music together. They played bluegrass. So that was the first live music. So I saw lots of instruments when I was a kid and singing. You know, I was around that all the time. And then my dad had a record collection that he played constantly.
So with your folks, what kind of bluegrass? Can you remember any of the artists?
Oh, yes. They played lots of Merle Haggard songs and Nashville Skyline Bob Dylan songs. They liked that stuff. Yeah.
That's a good foundation straight away, isn't it?
I think so, man. It really, you know, the older I get, the more I realize how influential that stuff was.
Do you sort of find yourself at the present day, kind of certain chord sequences or certain sounds and thinking, oh, yep, that was when I was six.
I think what I end up doing is, yeah, kind of going back to what makes me feel good. And that always tends to be the stuff that kind of reminds me of being a kid. Stanley Brothers, I mean, they were always the kings. The Stanley Brothers songs, Angel Band, you know, we sang that at my grandmother's grave when she passed away.
My latest son is taking phase. My race is nearly run. My strongest try.
So tell me about your father's record collection, because this is something you've mentioned a couple of times before. Mm-hmm. This kind of
he really had a good record collection.
This looms large in your legend.
Oh, yeah, and he let me use it. He taught me how to use the record player and how to handle the records. I mean, he had all the Beatles records, every single one of them. He had Robert Johnson.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door.
And he had all the Motown stuff, all the Otis Redding.
I've been loving you too long to stop now.
Well, you know, all the Smokey Robinson. He had Allman Brothers records.
I got to run to keep from hiding, and I'm bound to keep on riding.
He had Miles Davis records, and then he had like old Jewish records. He had Itzhak Perlman, stuff like that.
How did he become that guy that had this?
He's an old hippie. You know, he's just an old hippie. He loved his records, he loved his music.
Tell me a bit about one record that you can remember him kind of pulling out and you putting on and having that kind of moment. Because, you know, early on, as you say, there's really powerful reactions the first time you hear certain things, be it like a Smokey Robinson or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that probably Otis Redding, you know, would have been one of those things that before I was a musician, when I was just a kid listening to music, that it was really powerful. Just so immediate, so instantly lovable. Something so great about that. I remember those records in particular.
What track should we play at this juncture then?
He did, shoot. I mean, come on. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. I mean, everybody knows the song, but it never gets old.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting in the evening car, watching the ships roll in, and I'll watch them
watching the tide roll away. Just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. I had nothing to live for, looked like nothing. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. Look like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same.
Growing up around that much music, was it something that you took for granted early on in your life, that well, kind of everyone is surrounded by music, or was it always something that was kind of like important to you?
It was always very important to me, and I always was drawn to it. You know, my brother, he wasn't really into it. He didn't play music. He wasn't drawn to that, the stuff that my family did, you know, like my mom's family playing music. But I got that bug, so that's all I wanted to do. I wanted to have a Martin guitar. I wanted to sing those songs, sing those harmonies.
We often ask people on this show, like, about the first record that they bought, but did you have that moment of going and finding, like, that first 7-inch album that belonged to you, and that maybe still...
I mean, the first thing that I bought, it's so different, because when I was at home, I would listen to one thing with my family, and then when I was with my friends, I would listen to more current music, you know what I mean? I think the first thing I bought myself was a cassette single.
What was it?
It was the Geto Boys, My Mind's Playing Tricks on Me.
Okay.
Which is heavily an Isley Brothers sample.
I make big money, I drive big cars, everybody know me. It's like I'm a movie star, but late at night, something ain't right. I feel I'm being tailed by the same sucker's headlights.
I mean, it was great storytelling, but the music is so great. And I realize now that I get older that it's like lots of my favorite songs were other songs to begin with, especially in hip-hop, and that was an Isley Brothers song.
So tell me about the first gig. Because there's two first gigs for people. There's the first gig you go and see, other than your family kind of performing. And then there's the first gig that you see that you think, I'd like to do that. What would be those two for you?
Well, I mean, my uncles, they used to go play at bars and stuff. So I would see them out. And
do you used to sort of sneak in underage?
It would be sort of more family-type places, you know, that serve food too. You know, I mean, when you play bluegrass music, your options are very limited, you know? They don't get the hot stages in bluegrass so much. That's the joke in Nashville. It's like a bluegrass musician will drive across like two states for $30 and a plate of catfish. That's sort of how it goes.
Okay, then the kind of the first big sort of commercial show, ticketed event you went to.
The first ticketed event I went to, there were two of them. My mom took me to one, my dad took me to one. My dad took me to see the Grateful Dead at Richfield Coliseum.
What do you remember from that show?
I just remember not knowing what the hell was going on.
Got my chips cashed in, keep trucking like the dude of man. Together, more or less in line, just keep trucking on.
I was in the parking lot waiting to get in, and everybody was like weird looking, and like they had all these little signs like "Make my dream come true." I was like, "What the hell is going on?" Everybody just wanted a ticket, or they wanted to find acid. And then I remember being inside the Coliseum, which was like, you know, proper basketball arena. So it was probably 18,000 people, and they were all dancing, and the band hadn't even come out yet.
This is amazing. I'm not on.
I was like, what is going on? And then my mom took me that same year to the outdoor pavilion, which I would later work at with the flag parking cars at the Blossom Music Center. And we saw Whitney Houston on her first tour.
What was that like?
We were out on the lawn. So she was like a little speck of bright 80s colors, you know, and the songs that I've heard on the radio. I hardly remember it because I could barely see it.
But you did see it.
I'm pretty sure I was there.
And all my dreams were shattered.
The Sonics. When did you first hear The Sonics? Because this
I heard The Sonics when I was working at a record shop.
One of those bands, you've kind of got all you need to know in one piece of 7-inch with their work, really, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. You know, they had the raw power of like Link Wray and the guitar gnarliness of Link Wray, but they had a great singer and they sang really great songs. I love The Sonics. They're almost the perfect rock and roll band.
What kind of record store worker were you?
I was like every record store worker. Lazy. And stupid, close-minded.
Your first band?
My first band was the Black Keys.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I played around town. I would play in bars, and I would play local gigs, like around Akron. And it was more like 3-hour sets, you know, with two little breaks. It was more like the entertainment of the evening, that kind of gig. You know what I mean? But it paid really nice. I make like $300 a night, you know, and I could work 4 or 5 nights a week.
And how old were you then?
I was 19.
That's good money for 19.
Oh, yeah. And I was living with my parents. So it was great money. Yeah, that's why it was hard for me to want to go like play rock and roll clubs for free. And so that was the thing. I would play these local clubs, and whatever they needed, I would provide. Like, do you need a three-piece band, or do you need a solo artist? Do you need somebody with just some drums or brushes? You know, I do whatever. I go play the brunch at the health food restaurant for tips. But then when I started with Pat, we started going to play the rock clubs, where you go play for $10 and get judged harshly. You know,
this is
this is a very different world.
Yeah. Know? Why did it work with you two?
We just had a natural connection right off the bat. I don't know what it was. Straight away. I mean, the first recordings we made were the demos that got us the record deal. So it was like that first day we started making little demos on the 4-track cassette, and that was it. I mean, it was so basic. I mean, all the songs that we were making up were songs that sort of I already knew, and I was like mutating them, old blues songs and folk songs. And Pat was just teaching himself how to play the drums, so he kept it really simple. And it just worked. I don't know.
It's a funny thing with some bands and some musicians just make a good noise when they're put with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's a strange chemistry.
It's hard to explain, because the same thing can be said for when you get together with someone that you're not vibing with at all. It's just nonsense. You know what I mean? I mean, we weren't a two-piece by choice. We tried to get bass players, keyboard bass players, too. We tried everybody out, and it was miserable. It sounded worse. We sounded smaller.
Really?
With the more people we tried to add. But, I mean, you know, we're in Akron, so it's a very small town. I don't know how to compare Akron to what city. It's like 250,000 people, or it was when I was there.
That's very small. Was that good for you, or was that bad for you?
I think it was crucial. Yeah, I think that's how we got ahead. We weren't from New York. We weren't from L.A. We weren't part of a scene. I think it was very important to be isolated. I think that helped us a lot. And that ended up being the thing that everybody wanted to talk about, is that we're from Akron, the middle of nowhere. You know what I mean?
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Dan Auerbach. And that was The Moan, the very first song released by the Black Keys back in 2002. And that's a version recorded for John Peel, right here at the BBC. Working our way through his influences, I did have to ask about the electric warrior himself, Mr. Mark Bolan. Tell me about T-Rex. When did you first fall in love with T-Rex?
You know, Pat introduced me to T-Rex probably on one of those early tours, and I'd never heard it before. Even working at the record shop, I never heard T-Rex. But I loved it because it was like, it was so bizarre to me because he was playing like these blues songs, but they made him sound so humongous and weird. I loved it. I loved the production. It's still like a high watermark for me for production, sound and feeling, overall feeling, really.
Yeah, I was going to say, on this new record, as well as other your stuff, there's like a compressed crunchiness mm-hmm. to the guitars that you get on those records.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I don't like when things are too detailed, you know, it kind of is boring. I'm not trying to make, like, documents of, Library of Congress or something. It's supposed to have a feeling and a sound to it, you know what I mean? So I tend to like records and producers that make their own sound. People like Willie Mitchell and Norman Petty and... You know, just they kind of come up with your own unique thing. Even Motown. I mean, Motown had a very unique sound. It wasn't natural at all, you know, but it felt really good. That's the thing that I'm always searching for when I'm in the studio.
What's the T-Rex track we should play?
Mystic Lady, I think.
Why that one?
Just because it sounds great.
Oh, baby, Mystic Lady, you do own. For my dogs to fry, yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, sliding, riding, sorceress in your dungaree. Got me on my knee, yeah. People in your life are cruel. Keep on riding it humble. The lovers in your life are fuel. Keep on riding it humble. Baby, baby, baby. Toes will rain. Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh, Bobby, you hit Harvey with the learned ones. Like a certain song. Yeah, 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 yeah. All the people in your life.
Only got a couple miles.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first musical moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is Dan Auerbach. And that was Dan's solo track, Shine On Me, taken from his new album, Waiting On A Song, which was out earlier this year. When was the moment that you felt the Black Keys connecting, when you're like, okay, our thing is now everyone's thing, or their thing as well?
Honestly, it was kind of when we left home. We had to go halfway around the world to even get respect kind of at home. No one took us seriously in Akron. They wouldn't play us really on the local radio station until we got some attention across the pond.
Was it like a gig or maybe a specific release when you kind of like, okay, this is getting played. I think this is happening.
I think it was when we got a review in Rolling Stone. That was a big deal for us. They reviewed our first record in Rolling Stone. And we went and toured Australia. I think it was the combination of those two things that, like, I don't know, I feel like things started to pick up at that point.
Can you remember any lines from that review?
No, but the guy who wrote it, his name is Peter Relic. He then became a sort of like a friend of ours. He's wild. He became our tour manager. He took us to a radio station one time in Holland, and he was fully on mushrooms, and he was supposed to be our tour manager. And he didn't tell us until afterwards. He just had this weird look in his eye, and he wasn't helpful. You know, we didn't know.
You're not managing anything right now.
We didn't know what was going on.
John Prine.
John Prine is somebody that I always knew when I was growing up, but I didn't really fully understand until I saw him live in Nashville. My friend Fergie took me to a place called the Station Inn. That's like kind of a world famous bluegrass spot. I saw him there. He does these annual Christmas shows there. I don't know. It was so direct, so much fun. Everything about it was so great. It was like I understood his music for the first time.
What track should we play?
You should play Daddy's Little Pumpkin. You should play that one.
That's a good title.
Yeah. He and my friend Pat McLaughlin wrote that one. And it's my daughter's favorite song.
You must be Daddy's little pumpkin. I can tell by the way you roll. You must be Daddy's little pumpkin. I can tell by the way you roll. Well, it's 11:15 and you're sleeping on the bedroom floor. I can see the fire burning right behind your eyes. I can see the fire burning, baby, burning right behind your eyes. You must have swallowed a candle or some other kind of surprise. I'm going down to Memphis, got $300 in cash. Yeah, I'm going down to Memphis, got $300 in cash. All the women in Memphis gonna see how long my money could last. Downtown, gonna rattle somebody's cage. Yeah, I'm going downtown, I'm gonna rattle somebody's cage. I'm gonna beat on my guitar and strut all around the stage. If you see my baby coming, don't you tell her that her daddy's in jail. If you see my baby coming, don't tell her that her daddy's in jail. She'd sell her little pumpkin just to raise her sweet daddy's bail. You must be Daddy's little pumpkin, I can tell by the way you roll. You must be Daddy's little pumpkin, I can tell by the way you roll. Well, you never do nothing to save your doggone soul.
With the Brothers album, it's 2010, which is when things seem to go up a gear. If you're a band and you're lucky enough to have that point where all of a sudden there's widespread recognition and things change and more things get flight cased and you get better food backstage.
Mm-hmm.
All bands kind of want it, but there's no rehearsal for when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
How did it feel? Grammys. Ta-da.
The Grammys were exciting, you know, I mean, because it was just so There were so many of them.
I'm not being humble, but there was quite a few.
It was like one year I went to the Grammys. I like won more Grammys than Kanye. Do you know what I mean? It was like I didn't know what the hell was going on. But it was okay for us because we started so small and we worked for so long that it wasn't like an overnight thing. I know bands that signed with major labels and they got a bus immediately and then they just sort of, it's just unhealthy. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know that there's any real way to prepare for touring arenas, but, you know, I think it helped us that we kind of like started from the ground up.
Lonely Boy comes out and then you've got one of those records and, you know, it's every window you pass is playing that song and every TV, sports comp, whatever, is using it. And that's not very common. Not many bands with long careers get a chance to have one of those songs. How do you feel about that track now?
I mean, I'm proud of it. I mean, I don't go around listening to it.
I've got it on my Walkman.
My window's the only one now that was blaring it. No, I don't know, man. It's like, it was exciting at the time, but also we were so wrapped up in working. It was like we didn't even stop to smell the roses. You know what I mean? It was like, yeah, because, you know, we did the Brothers record and then we did the next record and then we did the next record and we never really stopped. We kept touring in between making records. So there was no time off. Like, we didn't go on vacations. We're not like hanging out, you know, enjoying it really. We were like, we're just working all the time.
Was that a defense mechanism? Was that?
I just think that's what we do. That's what we did. That's what we're good at. That's what we like. I mean, for me, I didn't get into it to like be in New York City hanging out with models. You know what I mean? I wanted to like make music and be around musicians. So that was what we did, you know?
Tell me about your first impressions of meeting Brian Burton, Danger Mouse, because there is a definite it appears that you bring out the best in each other. I think that's what it looks like when I've seen interviews and I've heard the stuff that you've done together. There's always interesting avenues. What was your first impression? Because he's quite a reserved kind of guy.
See, Brian has a public persona and a private persona. And he doesn't let many people in to his private world. You know what I mean?
Smart guy.
He is very intelligent, you know? Way smarter than we are. But the first time I met him, he was going to produce our record, Attack and Release, and we made him come to Northeastern Ohio. And he never went anywhere to make records. Everybody came to him. But we asked him, and he's like, okay, I guess. And not only did we make him go to Northeastern Ohio, we made him go to Painesville, which is like 45 minutes east of Cleveland in the woods. In this old dilapidated mansion, there's a studio. The guy who invented baby formula built this big kind of mid-century mansion, and there's a studio in there in the woods. It's awesome. It's an amazing place, but it's in the middle of nowhere.
It sounds like the start of a horror movie.
I think that Brian, being like the only black guy in town, really truly felt that it was probably like that. And I didn't think about it at the time, but he was brave for being there with us.
And it worked straight away.
And it was great. We had so much fun. I mean, he's a great guy. I mean, he's lots of fun to be around, and he's just, he's got great taste in music. He's always, you know, we're always kind of playing stuff for each other and trying to, like, out-playlist each other. But he's got that same addiction that we have is like, being in the studio and being creative. He loves it.
Tell me about J.J. Cale. When was the first time you fell in love with J.J. Cale?
Well, my uncle used to play J.J. Cale. And J.J. Cale is more of a feeling than anything else. Like, you, that record will be on, and you won't know why you feel so good, and then all of a sudden, you realize it's because J.J. Cale's been playing for 30 minutes, you know? And his records are magical. I mean, they're so confident and understated. I know that Eric Clapton had really big hits with some of his songs, and so did Lynyrd Skynyrd, but, like, his records are so good. But, yeah, I must have been 18 when I first heard him, something like that.
What's the track we should play?
You should play Magnolia.
You're sweet thing. dive underneath me. I got to get back to you, babe. Get the style.
Dr. John, how do you, like, ask Dr. John?
Well, you got to be obsessive. I, like, had to call him, and I had to fly there by myself. I got on a plane, flew down to New Orleans. He was, like, staying at some ex-con's house who takes care of him, cooks for him. And I went there, knocked on the door of this duplex in the middle of, like, this unsuspecting type of little neighborhood. And
did you know you were coming?
Yeah, he knew I was coming. And he answered the door, and I basically had to talk him into it.
Tell me about that conversation.
Well, the thing is, Dr. John, he's like Brian. He's got a public persona and a personal one. And he's got a public accent and a private one. Like, if he doesn't know you, his accent is so thick you can't understand anything. Like, all that. It gives you all that. When I first called him, he was giving me all that. But then when he finally realized I was for real, then all of a sudden, like, you could understand his words. It's a defense mechanism. He's been ripped off by so many people throughout his life. But, you know, I just went down there, and he had all these books filled with poetry. And he let me read through them, and I was like, come on, man, let's get you in the studio. This is going to happen. And it did. And I knew it was going to happen.
It's a good record. It's a really good record.
I love that record,
yeah.
Man. And we made that record in like a week and a half.
Really?
You know? Yeah. And he didn't have any songs ahead of time. We arranged them all in the studio, and then I worked with him on arranging that poetry into melodies and... It was great. It was so natural, though. And you know, that was the first time I really ever worked with a musician like that. I work with them now, like musicians kind of seasoned like that. But guys who made a living in the studio making records, coming up with parts guys, you know what I mean? All those great studios, they used to be filled with those kind of guys. And to be around that is really eye-opening. It's really eye-opening.
Stretched out like a rubber chair.
find that your constant quest for the next thing, is it ceaseless? Is it always with you? Because you don't seem to stop, ever. I kind of, I guess that's a good thing, but I guess it's also going to make life quite difficult.
Yeah, it does, I think. It does make life kind of difficult. And the more I just accept it, too, it's sort of like, this is what I do. My family knows this is what I do. But it's kind of nice, like with these guys who played on my new record, these older guys who have been working in studios their whole lives, making records, it's their first love. And I finally, like, kind of found more people like me who their family knows also, like, this is what they do. And when they're going to work, you kiss them goodbye, and then, you know, you don't know when you're going to see them. It's like going off to war. A very tame war where you don't get injured. But I don't know. It's just what I do, and I love it. And I feel like the more I just give up to it, the more fruitful it's become. The more I try to, like, pretend like I'm normal and, like, go on vacations and, like, go on a bike ride, the less satisfied I feel in my life. At this point in time, I need to kind of just be obsessive about it, because that's just what I need to do.
What's the funnest song that we should play?
Jack the Ripper, Link Wray. Come on.
Why that song?
Because it's a good way to end. It's a good way to end anything. That was how we walked out of my wedding, is Jack the Ripper.
Then that's the song we should play. It's good to speak to you. Thank you very much.
You too, man. Good to see you.
Music.
Save us from the bar and chain. This morning at 11,
Amy LeMay.
At 8,
Radcliffe and McConie.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.